Toby has chosen Job chapter 1 for the reading. Thank you, Toby.
Thanks, Josh, and thanks everyone for coming out tonight. We've got a pretty incredible book to look at, and hopefully as we walk through Job's story tonight and try and conquer this book, you too will be excited by what we can learn. So first up, what are we going to cover tonight? First, we're going to take a few seconds to look at the setting of the book. Then we'll take a brief look at the characters. Then we want to walk through the meaty part, the story. We'll look at the five disasters. We'll look at Job's friend's advice. We'll then look at Job's progression, his faith, his progression to self-confidence. And then we'll look at Elihu and God and how they respond to Job. Okay, so a few questions to address before we start. Firstly, is the book of Job real or is it just a parable? So Job is only mentioned twice outside of his own book, and both times it's in a way that indicates that he is a real person. So in Ezekiel 14, verse 14 to 20, God is talking about how inescapable his coming judgments are on Jerusalem. And he says in verse 20, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, which is Jerusalem, they could only save themselves by their righteousness, declares the sovereign Lord. Job's also mentioned in James 5 verse 11, which we probably know. It says, behold, we count them happy which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is pitiful and tender and of tender mercy. So why do we think Job's a real person? Well, in Ezekiel, Job's mentioned alongside Noah and Daniel. They're both real characters. And in James, Job is used as an example of patience, which wouldn't hold much value if he wasn't a real person. Question number two, what time in history did the book of Job occur? I think simply we can put it between occurring before the law of Moses, but after the flood. So why before the law? Well, there's never any reference made to Israel or the law of Moses in the book of Job, which would be unusual if you're a believer and you lived during the time of the law of Moses. Also, Job acts as a priest for his family, which was commonly done by people like Abraham and Jacob. They do it. They offer sacrifices. They build altars for themselves and for their family. And this was only done before the law of Moses instituted priests from the line of Aaron. One more reason that indicates Job lived before the law is Job's long length of age. So Job 42 verse 16 tells us, after this lived Job 140 years. So after Job had his first 10 kids, after he built up his business, after he suffered all the trials that he did, he lives for 140 years longer. So if we say that Job's about 40 years old when all these disasters strike, then he lived for at least 180 years. If we look to sections of the Bible where people live for that sort of period of time, we find Abraham lived for 175 years, and then characters from there steadily live for less and less long. So Isaac lives for 160 years, and then when we get to Moses, Moses lives for 120 years. So we think Moses lived before the law of Moses. We think Job lived before the law of Moses. Why do we think Job lived after the flood? Well, Job 22 verse 16 mentions the wicked being overthrown with a flood, which is most probably a reference to the time of Noah. Another reason comes from one of Job's friends who is a Temanite. It's Eliphaz the Temanite. If we trace back the beginnings of the Temanites, we find that Esau had a grandson called Duke Teman. And so the earliest we can have a Temanite exist is many generations down from Esau, who was Abraham's grandson. So Job had to have existed after Abraham if there's a friend he has who is a Temanite. Final question is, where did the story take place? So Job 1 verse 3 says that Job was the greatest of all the men in the east. To an Israelite, everything that was on the other side of Jordan, the other side of the Jordan River was east. So that means that we're getting on the right of the Jordan, my right of the Jordan, because of the River Jordan, also, Job 1 verse 1, it mentions that Job was from the land of Uz. Uz is mentioned a couple other times in the Bible, in Jeremiah 25 verse 20 and in Lamentations 4. And it's mentioned in connection with Egypt, with Philistia, with Edom, and with Moab. So Moab was northeast of the Dead Sea. So we're talking about here. Edom was directly below the Dead Sea. Egypt was northwest, so the other side of the Dead Sea. And then Philistia was about directly west of the Dead Sea. So you're getting that zone below the Dead Sea there, which is where we think the land of Uz is probably located. So moving on, we're going to take a quick look at the five characters that we'll meet in this story and that we'll meet through tonight. So first we meet Job. He's introduced in chapter 1. We read that tonight, and the story follows Job the whole way through. We then meet character number 2. He's also introduced in chapter 1, and he's Satan. He disappears halfway through chapter 2, and we don't see him again. We then meet Job's three friends. Their character's number 3. There's three friends, as their character number 3. Just don't question that one. Then towards the end of the story, we meet character number 4, which is Elihu. He magically appears in the later chapters and then disappears after he finishes speaking. And then the last character we meet is God. He's present the whole way through the story, but specifically he talks in chapter 38 for a fair period of time talking to Job. So they're the five key characters of the book, and we want to work our way through the story now and get to know these characters as we hear from them and as they speak. So diving into chapter 1 now, Job 1 verse 1 says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil." Straight away we get this glowing description of Job. From the first verse of the entire book, we read that Job was perfect or blameless. He was upright. He was someone who feared God, and he eschewed evil, or he turned away from evil. Read verse 2 with me. "And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East." So Job's got a family, he's got a wife, and he's got 10 kids. He's got an enormous number of livestock. He's got sheep, camels, cows, donkeys, and many servants. Out of everyone in the East, Job was the greatest. Everything Job did was a success, and everyone in the whole area knew it. In talking about this period of his life later in chapter 29, Job tells us that wherever he went, people stopped and stood while he passed. Whenever he talked, people listened and had their questions answered. He was incredibly generous to all who needed care. He helped the blind and the lame. He was a father to the poor. He brought joy to people's lives. And at the end of Job's description of himself in chapter 29, he says, "I chose out their way and sat chief and dwelt as a king in the army, as one that comforteth the mourners." So we're getting this picture of incredible success and prosperity painted of Job at the beginning. However, it wasn't just wealth and success and business prospects that Job has. His faith and his love of God, his desire to pursue righteousness, was also 100% on fire. Job was passionate about doing God's will, so passionate that after his kids visited one another and had a feast, Job would jump out of bed in the morning, call his children to him, and sacrifice burnt offerings for them all, just in case they had sinned and cursed God. Job did this continually. That means all his days. Job made a habit of doing this. He gathered his children, he offered sacrifices for them, and sanctified them, just to make sure they were right in God's sight. What a faithful father he is, and how much does he care for his family. So the opening picture we get painted of Job is that he is perfect and upright. He has thousands of animals and a great household. He's well known in the area as generous and kind. He's called the greatest of all the men in the East. But he's also passionate about serving God and keeping his family on the right track. Job's faith is painted so clearly here in the record for us. It's one of the opening things that the writer of Job makes every effort to get us to see. So let's continue reading in verse 6. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves unto Yahweh, and Satan came also among them." So now we meet character number 2, Satan. So who is Satan and what is he doing? There's lots of explanations for who Satan is, but I'll try and explain to you what I think makes the most sense. And if you think I'm wrong, I'm happy to chat about it after we finish tonight. So the Hebrew word Satan just means opponent or adversary or withstand. In the Hebrew, the definite article is used. What does that mean? It just means that instead of writing Satan, it should be written the Satan. So it should be written as the opponent or the adversary. This indicates that the opponent of Job is a specific being. It's not just Satan, it's the Satan, the opponent. So could the opponent have been an angel sent by God? Well, the opponent's attitude is resentful, it's jealous, and it's antagonistic. The opponent is scornful of Job's service and doubtful of his genuineness, which is uncharacteristic of angels. We read in Hebrews 1 verse 14 of angels, it says, Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? So this description we get of angels in Hebrews doesn't really fit with the idea that the Satan in Job is an angel. The Satan in Job is jealous and scornful, and we read in Hebrews that angels are ministering spirits to serve those who are heirs of salvation. So if the opponent or the Satan isn't an angel, then what does he represent? Does he represent the jealous thoughts of someone or multiple people in the area? Well, the record presents the opponent as a real person. He comes with the other believers. He presents himself. He converses with God. He understands and responds to God. And he comes back to question God a second time. So I think Satan, or the opponent, is a real person. That's how the record presents it. We could go into more detail. We can further apply representations to him. But for sake of time, we'll leave it at that. We think that Satan is a real person. So moving on to verse 9 to 12, where Satan has his conversation with God. This opponent hated how successful Job was. And when he compares himself with Job, he feels the need to doubt Job, to downplay his own inadequacies and unfaithfulness. The opponent was convinced that Job was only faithful because God had made him so wealthy. And so if God would just remove his wealth to reduce Job down to a poor man, Job's pretense of being a faithful servant of God would disappear. And everyone would see that Job was really just as bad as this opponent thought. So this brings us to the second half of chapter 1. We see four brutal destructions of all that Job had. So starting verse 14, and there came a messenger unto Job and said, Job, your 500 yoke of oxen and your 500 asses have been stolen, and all the servants who take care of these animals, they were violently killed. What a shock. Not just the animals, but the servants as well. Job knew and loved these servants. He'd have dinner with them. He would discuss business matters with them. He trusted them to take care of thousands of his animals. What a shock to get over. What pain you would feel if half of the people you worked with died in a sudden event. What stress you would feel if the business you owned lost half its assets. If your investment value dropped by 50%, or if your tractors, your semi-trailers, your plowing machinery, and your cars were destroyed. Verse 16, while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, Job, it's a freak bushfire. All your 7,000 sheep were burnt and destroyed. They're unable to escape the fire. And all the servants who cared for these sheep, they didn't make it out alive either. What a crippling loss. So many servants Job loved, and most of what was left of his decimated business, it's gone. Imagine if your production machinery was destroyed, or if your silos and your warehouses were torn down by a sudden accident, and if only one contact was left to come and tell you the shocking news. Verse 17. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, Job, I'm sorry, your 3,000 camels, they've been taken by bands of robbers, and they killed all the servants who were there. I'm the only one who managed to escape. That's catastrophic. That's all that Job had left. It's been taken. And all the servants Job had left, they've been killed like the rest. What to do? Imagine that you were Job at the beginning of this story. Imagine the first disaster. Half your business destroyed, half your work colleagues and trusted workers who you know and love killed. That's loss and grief at an enormous level. Then the second disaster strikes, this time destroying almost everything that's still left. You have just a fraction of what was once a prosperous, successful business. Then another unforeseeable event hits, and all that was left of your shattered business and your life is destroyed. You have no servants, you have no business, you have no stock. Most of us would say it couldn't get worse. Verse 18, while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, your sons and your daughters, Job, they were celebrating together at your son's house, and a whirlwind came and blew straight through the house. It destroyed everything, and your kids, they didn't make it out. That's tragic. The loss of one child or one family member or one relative or one loved one is crushing. Imagine losing your entire family, all your sons, all your daughters, all your brothers and sisters, all their wives, and if they had children, all of them too. How would we respond? How do we respond when something horrible or hard or tragic happens to us? Our faith can be shaken. We can question God's goodness. We can wonder if God is really with us, or if he cares about us, or if he's in control of the little things in our life. We can wonder if it's worth it, or if there's a way through. Job's response is completely incredible. His faith shines out of the record. Let's read verse 20 to 22. I'll read it from the ESV. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. Yahweh gave, and Yahweh has taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Job had the faith to still acknowledge God as the sole provider. He had the faith to still trust God, to know that God knows what is right. He had the faith to trust that God is in control and is the giver of good and evil. He had the faith to know that everything we have been given in this life is a blessing from God. This is complete submission to God's will. It's firm faith in God's goodness, faith that no matter what happens, no matter if we lose everything we ever had, our business, our income, our house, our savings, our children, our brothers and sisters, our family, God is good and God is in control. God is still to be praised. He says, blessed be the name of Yahweh. In all this trial, in all this loss, in all this suffering, Job did not sin or accuse God of doing wrong. That's incredible faith. Well, he doesn't get a break. In chapter 2, the opponent comes back to God, and God says to him, reading chapter 2, verse 3, and Yahweh said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. God's assessment of this situation, of Job's mindset and his faith, is that Job is blameless and upright. He still holds fast his integrity and faith. He still remains innocent. Well, this opponent has one more crack at Job. He says, people will give everything they have to save their own life. Chapter 2, verse 5. Let's read. Chapter 2, verse 5. He says, but stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. So God does. God struck Job with a painful, horrific disease, boils from the bottom of his feet to the very top of his head. Verse 8. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself withal, and he sat down among the ashes. Let's read verse 9 and 10. Then said his wife unto him, dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. But he said unto her, Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God? And shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. Everything that Job has suffered up to the boils, his wife has suffered too. She's had her servants killed, her children crushed, and now to see her husband not only distraught and saddened, but also physically afflicted, it breaks her. Job is in so much pain, she would prefer for his own sake that he would just curse God and die. But once again, we see Job's incredible faith shining through. He says, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? It's the echo from his response in chapter 1. He says in chapter 1, we read it, the Lord gave, and Yahweh hath taken away. So again, in chapter 2, we see Job's submission to God's will. We see his firm faith in God's goodness, his faith that remains fully confident that no matter what, even if he lost everything, God was in control. His faith that living a life of faith before God is worth it, that sticking with God is worth far more than this life. So back to chapter 2, let's read verse 11 to 13. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and comfort him. And when they had lifted their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept. And they rent every one his mantle and sprinkled dust upon their head towards heaven. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and seven nights. And none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. So now we meet characters number 3, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. These are Job's three friends. They come to visit Job, and upon seeing him so hurt, so distressed, and in so much suffering, they break down. They tear their clothes and they cry vocally and loudly. Then they go and sit with him. They put dirt on their heads, making themselves filthy like Job would have been, and they mourn for hours and hours and hours. Sometimes our friends are accused of being ingenuine or fake, or of coming with jealous thoughts to accuse Job of wrong. This doesn't fit with the story. Imagine for a moment that you were in the shoes of the friends. Something horrible, misfortunate, and completely unexpected has happened to your friend, to someone you know and love. Maybe it's a breakup. Maybe it's a chronic illness. Maybe a bushfire or flooding has destroyed their home. Or maybe it's the loss of someone they love. How do we normally respond when our friend has something like this happen to them? Well, we're there for them. We go and visit them. We take them out for lunch. We call them. We message them. We reach out and tell them we're thinking of them. We go out of our way to bear their burden. When they share with us what they're going through, we sit and listen and let them get it all off their chest. And maybe we're good enough to hold inside the words we want to say, our sympathy, our advice, for a whole hour. That's a long time to sit and listen and be there for a friend. These friends sat with Job for a week, 7 whole days. No talking, no popping out for dinner, no visiting their families, no going back to work, just them and Job sitting together. 7 days without their families, 7 days away from their work, 7 days away from running their business. That's genuine, true friendship. That's giving your own time for a friend. What faithful friends they are. And what an example to us of faithfulness to our friends, of being there through thick and thin, of genuine selflessness for others. So there they sit, offering companionship in the silence, waiting for Job to speak. Chapter 3, verse 1. After this, opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. He suffered so much. He survived so much trial. He wishes for death. And in chapter 3, Job describes in 3 different ways how he wishes that right now, rather than continue suffering, he could be dead. Chapter 3 details these 3 descriptions from Job. So the first way Job describes his longing for death, verse 3 of chapter 3, he says, "Let the day perish wherein I was born and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived." Job wishes that he had never been born. For if he had never been born, then he would never have had to endure the events that have come upon him. What a state to be in to wish that you were never born. Well, the second way Job expresses his wish for death is in verse 11. Let's read verse 11. He says, "Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the spirit when I came out of the belly?" Friends, Job says, I wish I wasn't born. But since I was born, I wish that I'd died in birth. He continues in verse 16. He says, "I wish that I'd been a stillborn child. For in the grave, the weary find rest, and the captives can be at peace." Again, we see Job's low, afflicted state. He feels that what he's endured is so bad that to die in birth would have been a liberty. Finally, the last way that Job describes his longing and his longing for death, let's read verse 20 to 22. "Why is light given to those in misery, and life to the bitter of soul, to those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasures, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave?" Job says, "I wish that I was dead now. I wish that I was dead now because I'd be filled with joy if I could just die." So the 3 points Job makes in chapter 3. First, I wish that I'd never been born, but since I was born, I wish that I had died in birth. But finally, since I didn't die in birth, I wish that I would die now. We can't really imagine how Job is feeling, or how much sadness surrounds him and how much pain fills his body. Life to Job has turned into a curse, not a blessing. The only thing he longs for is death. It will end what he is enduring. Well, Job's friends have come to comfort him. So how do they respond? Put on the perspective of his 3 friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Over the past 7 days, they've sat with their friend. He's in a broken, sickly state, and you're truly worried that he might die. You've been wondering what Job is thinking and what possible sin he could have committed to deserve such suffering. You've waited long and you've waited patiently for Job to speak, to break the silence and to explain what he's done wrong. But when he speaks, he doesn't admit anything. In fact, it sounds like Job thinks he hasn't done anything wrong. So let's turn to Job's 3 friends. What do they say? Well, they speak 3 times each, except for Zophar. He doesn't speak his final time. He's got nothing left to say. During all this time, they don't really make any progress. They repeat themselves, they repeat each other, and they continue to say the same thing over and over again. So we'll look at each of the friends and their key thoughts, but we'll really only look at the first time they speak, because from there, they don't really make any progress in the 20 chapters that they have dialogue with Job. So Eliphaz speaks first. He's the oldest member of the group, and he has the most experience and wisdom out of everyone there, so it's natural and right that he would speak first. Let's read Job chapter 4, verse 1. "Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said," verse 7 and 8, jumping down to verse 7 and 8, "Remember, I pray thee, who ever perished being innocent? Or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same." Eliphaz bases his argument on personal experience. He reasons based on what he's seen in his lifetime. When he speaks again in chapter 15, his second speech, he says the same thing. He says, "I will show you, hear me, that which I have seen will I declare. So in a life as his experience, which is what he bases his reasoning on, you only suffer if you've sinned. So in Job's case, whose suffering is severe, Job must have sinned severely. Eliphaz points out in chapter 5 that the children of the wicked are crushed, and that's pointed. And he points out that the possessions of the wicked are stolen by robbers. That's harsh. But he's the most kindly of the friends, and he spends the rest of chapter 5 with a plea to Job to repent. If we read chapter 5, verse 8, he says there, "I would seek unto God, and unto God would I commit my cause." And then jumping down to chapter 5, verse 18, he says, "For God maketh sore and bindeth up. He woundeth, and his hands make whole. He shall deliver thee in 6 troubles, yea, in 7 there shall no evil touch thee." Well, after Job replies to Eliphaz, Bildad steps up to speak, and he's not so kind. Where Eliphaz softened the beginning of his speech by talking about Job's previous prosperity and his kindness, Bildad cuts straight to the chase. If we go to chapter 8, verse 1, "Then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said," verse 2, "How long wilt thou speak these things? And how long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? Doth God pervert judgment? Or doth the Almighty pervert justice?" So Bildad thinks Job's words are empty, and he bases his argument on tradition. Verse 8 from the ESV says, "For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are of but yesterday, and know nothing. For our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter the words out of their understanding?" So Bildad tells Job to look back on tradition and what the elders and fathers of old would say. He talks of a reed and how easily a reed withers. And in verse 13 he says, "So are the paths of all that forget God, and the hypocrite's hope shall perish." So to Bildad, tradition is key. Tradition tells him that suffering is because of sin. Still at the end of chapter 8, when Bildad finishes his first speech, he finishes with a message of hope. He says, verse 20 to 21 of chapter 8, he says, "Behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers, till he fill thy mouth with laughing and thy lips with rejoicing." So Bildad places his argument on tradition, but he still finishes with that message of hope. Then again, Job replies, and finally Zophar steps up in chapter 11. If we go to chapter 11. If Bildad was kind or direct, then Zophar is cruel. He says in verse 3 of chapter 11, "Should thy lies make men hold their peace? When thou mockest, shall no men make thee ashamed?" And at the end of verse 6, we see he says, "Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth." Bildad is blunt. He says to Job, "Job, you haven't been punished enough." Zophar is blunt, sorry. And he says to Job, "Job, you haven't been punished enough." He doesn't use personal experience or tradition as his basis. He simply accuses Job and appeals to common sense. And in chapter 20, when he speaks for the second time, he says, "Do you not know this from old, since man was placed on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short?" He says, "Job, isn't it obvious that the wicked don't last long before they're struck by suffering?" To Zophar, it's obvious and clear, and Job just needs to face it. So that's the three friends of Job. They give their opinions, they state their standing, and they use everything they have to try and make Job see from their points of view. Well, what about Job? Where does Job stand throughout his friends' words? Well, he's on a whole nother wavelength. We looked at chapter 3 where he longs for death, but over the next 30 chapters, he comes a long way. While the friends are arguing about suffering being a cause of sin, being the result of sin, sorry, Job is trying to work out his standing with God and his argument with God. His faith slowly progresses through these chapters, but so does his sense of self-confidence. So we're going to look at those two aspects now through Job's speeches, the development of his faith and confidence in God, but also the development of his self-righteousness. So first, the development in Job's faith that we see through the first 30 or so chapters. Come with me to chapter 16, verse 19. Oh, sorry. Come back with me to chapter 9 first. Chapter 9, verse 33. We'll read that first. Job says in chapter 9, verse 33, "Nor is there any mediator between us who may lay his hand upon us both." So what's Job saying? He's saying, there's no one between me and God. I feel alone, I feel separate from God, and I feel punished. He goes on to say that he's terrified and he's fearful to even speak. So here it seems that Job's faith is at an all-time low. His relationship with God is petering out and he's too terrified to even talk to God. Now let's come to chapter 16. Chapter 16, verse 19. Job has made some progress. He says in verse 19, "Also now, behold, my witness is in heaven and my record is on high." So in chapter 9, where Job was too fearful to even talk to God, now in chapter 16, we see him appealing to God and saying that his witness is on high. So maybe God is paying attention to Job. Maybe Job's faith is lifting. Well, let's go to the end of chapter 19. Reading from verse 23, Job says, "Oh, that my words were now written." So gone is the Job that was too terrified to speak to God. Reading on. "Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I see for myself. And mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me." So we've come a long way from chapter 9, where Job's too terrified to speak to God. Now it appears that a lot of Job's confidence is back. He talks boldly about death, and he proclaims that even though he probably will die, he knows that God lives and that he will be raised. But here's the problem. Although Job's faith and Job's confidence is growing, so too is his sense of self-righteousness. And through his speeches, he becomes to increasingly accuse God of cruelty, of mindless destruction, and of injustice. Let's run through a few quotes that show this. So come with me to chapter 9, verse 17. We'll look at some verses in chapter 9. So chapter 9, starting at verse 17, Job says, "Of God, for he breaketh me with a tempest and multiplieth my wounds without cause." What's Job saying? He's saying that God destroys him for no reason. So he's accusing God of mindless destruction, of causing ruin and devastation with no purpose. Chapter 9, verse 23, let's read that. Job says in chapter 9, verse 23, "If the scourge slay suddenly, he will laugh at the trial of the innocent." So Job's saying that God doesn't care if the innocent suffer. He's accusing God of indifference to suffering and pain, of not caring about good, honest people, and of laughing when his faithful servants suffer unjustly. Come with me to chapter 16, verse 9. We'll pick a verse out from there. Chapter 16, verse 9, Job says, "He has torn me in his wrath and hated me. He has gnashed his teeth at me. My adversary sharpeneth his eyes against me." So what's Job saying? He's saying that God hates him. He's saying that God is acting like an enemy. God is harassing him. He's hunting him down. He's tearing him apart. He's snapping his teeth at him. He's persecuting him. And finally, let's go to chapter 30. Job speaks more about God in chapter 30, verses 20 to 21. Job says, "I cry unto thee, and thou dost not hear me. I stand up, and thou regardest me not. Thou art become cruel to me. With thy strong hand thou opposest thyself against me." Job accuses God, right towards the end of his speeches here in verse 30, of acting with cruelty and disregard, of being uncaring, of being cruel. What a way to describe God. He accuses God of mindless destruction. He accuses God of indifference to suffering and pain, of being a hateful, angry enemy, of being an uncaring, cruel opponent. Well, this leads right into Job's proclamation of his own self-righteousness. He feels that God has mistreated him, and so God should apologize for what he has done. Let's look at two places where this comes out in Job's speeches. Starting in chapter 23, let's turn there. So chapter 23, reading from verse 3 to verse 7 in the ESV. Job says, chapter 23, verse 3 to 7, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know what he answered me and understand what he say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would pay attention to me. There an upright man could argue with him, and I would be acquitted forever by my judge." That's a bold statement. Job is saying one simple thing here. If I could just find God and have a meeting with him, I could prove that I'm right. I could prove that even though God is so powerful, I do not deserve the suffering that I've been through. God would have to listen to me if I had this meeting with God. So let's turn to the end of Job's speech in chapter 31. This same attitude comes out there. Reading chapter 31, verse 35 to 37. Job says, "Oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me, and that mine adversary had written a book. Surely I would take it upon my shoulders and bind it as a crown to me. I would declare unto him the number of my steps as a prince, would I go near unto him." Job is so confident in his own goodness here at the end of his speeches that he says that if God wrote a book telling of all Job's wrongs, he would carry it around proudly. He would come to talk to God as confident as a prince. So we've seen that Job's faith has grown, but so too has his self-righteousness. He's accused God of mindless destruction, of carelessness towards suffering and pain, of being hateful, cruel, and acting as an enemy. He's claimed that if he could meet with God and come into his presence, he would do it confidently, and God would not be able to argue with him, but would listen to him and give him deliverance. Let's read chapter 32, verse 1. "So these three men, Job's three friends, ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes." In Job's final words to his friends, they're not actually in the end of chapter 31. His final words to his friends are in chapter 24, where he utterly defeats them. He describes in detail in chapter 24 how the wicked prosper, how the wicked punish and oppress the poor and are not punished for it. And he ends chapter 24 by saying, "And if it is not so, who will make me a liar? Who will make my speech of nothing worth?" So what does Job say at the end of 24? He says, "Friends, the wicked do prosper. The righteous do suffer. Prove me wrong." So the friends have nothing left to say. Their argument of sin brings suffering is defeated, and they can't prove Job wrong. And as we see in chapter 32, verse 1, so these three men cease to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. So enter scene Elihu. He's character number 4. For the first time in the whole story, we're introduced to Elihu. He appears to be there the whole way through. He quotes Job a number of times. And when he steps up to speak, no one's surprised that he's there. So it's likely that he was there the whole time. In chapter 32, Elihu finally speaks. It's clear that Elihu has waited a long time to speak, and now that he's finally talking, no one's going to stop him. Elihu tells us himself in chapter 32 that he sat and listened to friends, Job's friends talk and talk and talk. His anger whilst he was listening was rising and rising as he waited and waited until, read with me verse 18 of chapter 32. Verse 18 to 20, Elihu says, "For I am full of a matter, the spirit within me constraineth me. Behold, my belly is as wine which hath no vent. It is ready to burst like new bottles. I will speak that I may be refreshed. I will open my lips and answer. So Elihu can't restrain himself anymore. The friends haven't been able to answer Job, and they've talked for 30-odd chapters with Job, and now Elihu will answer Job. So what does he say? He's carefully listened, and now he's going to answer Job. Come to chapter 33, verse 8 to 11. So this is the approach that Elihu takes when he's answering Job is that he sat there and listened to Job speak, and now he's going to quote Job back. So he quotes a section that Job says, and then he tells Job why he is wrong. So chapter 33, verse 8 to 11. Elihu says, "Surely thou hast spoken in mine hearing, and I have heard the voice of thy words saying, I am clean without transgression, I am innocent. Neither is there iniquity in me. Behold, he findeth occasions against me. He counteth me for his enemy. He putteth my feet in the stocks. He marketh all my paths." So that's Elihu quoting Job's words there. According to Elihu, Job has said that he has no sin and that God counts him as an enemy despite his sinlessness. Well, we know that's true when we're looking at what Job has claimed. He claimed that God treats him like an enemy. So what's Elihu's reply? Well, verse 12, let's read verse 12 of chapter 33. He says, "Behold, in this you are not right. I will answer thee that God is greater than man." It's pretty clear from Elihu. He tells Job that he's wrong and that the very idea of arguing with God is absurd because God is infinitely greater than us. So let's continue down to verse 13. This is the second time that Elihu quotes Job in telling Job why he is wrong. Reading chapter 33, verse 13 from the ESV, it puts it a little more clearly. "Why do you contend against him, saying, he will answer none of man's words?" So here Elihu is quoting Job, and Job is saying that God doesn't answer any man's words. Again, we've seen Job say this in chapter 30, where he accused God of not hearing him and disregarding him. So what does Elihu say? Let's read verse 14. "For God does speak once, yea, twice, yet man perceiveth it not." Look at the beginning of verse 15. Elihu goes on to say, "In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men." So that's how God sometimes communicates. God isn't silent and God does listen. And as we see in verse 15, God communicates in a dream or in a vision. Look down further to verse 19. Elihu goes on and he says, "He's chastened also with pain upon his bed and a multitude of his bones with strong pain." What's the point? So Elihu's saying that God does communicate. Verse 15, God communicates in visions. Verse 19, God communicates through life events like suffering. Why does God communicate with people like this? Let's read verse 29 to 30. Elihu says, "Lo, all these things worketh God, oftentimes with man, to bring back his soul from the pit, to be enlightened with the light of the living." So there's Elihu's point. Job has claimed that God doesn't listen and that he never responds to his faithful servants. Well, Elihu tells Job that God does communicate. He communicates through visions, and one of the ways he communicates is through suffering and pain, so that we will shine the light of life. Let's read verse 31. "Mark well, O Job, hearken unto me. Hold thy peace, and I will speak. If thou hast anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify thee." Does Job reply? No, he doesn't answer a single word. Job has claimed that God is uncaring and unresponsive. And now Elihu is starting to show him that God is actually responsive. That maybe the suffering that Job is going through is God trying to communicate with Job and to test him. So Job is realizing that maybe he's missing the point. Well, Elihu goes on to speak for another four chapters. He keeps on quoting Job, and he keeps on giving the reply. In chapter 34, Job said there's no benefit to trying to please God. Elihu reminds Job, that God never does wickedness or acts unjustly. Further down in chapter 35, Elihu quotes Job's claim that he's more righteous than God and speaks of God's power. "It's impossible for a human," says Elihu, to be more powerful and more righteous than God. So in these few chapters from verse 32 to 37, Elihu's answered Job. He quotes Job's claims and accusations against God and proves to Job that he was wrong. He spoke that and that Job spoke foolishly. He's completely dismantled Job, so much so that when he invites Job to reply to give his defense, Job has nothing to say. He is silent. Well, all that Elihu said, all that he's proved to Job, it's a stepping stone to prepare Job for chapter 38. Come with me to chapter 38. Chapter 38, starting from verse 1. Then Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, so Yahweh has stepped up and Yahweh is now speaking. He says in verse 2, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up thy loins like a man, Job. I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if thou hast understanding, who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest, or who has stretched out the line upon it? So God's finally answered Job. Job's been begging for 30 chapters for God to speak up and to answer him, and God has finally answered him. So a brief summary of chapters 38 and 39. God speaks and he describes his creation in intricate detail. We read at the beginning of chapter 38, he talks about laying the foundations of the earth. God then describes how he shaped the sea, how he made the clouds, and how he controls the snow and rain. He talks about the constellations of the stars, about thunder, about lightning. And then he describes all the animals he's created, the wild goats, the deer, the wild donkeys and the untamed bull. He talks of the ostrich, the horse, the eagle. And then in chapter 40, after speaking of his creation, God asks Job for an answer. Let's go to chapter 40, verse 3. God says, then Job answered Yahweh and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer, yea, twice, but I will proceed no further. So Job has nothing to say. God's answered him. Job finally has this court that he's longed for with God, where he can prove his point to God, where he can argue that he's right, and he has nothing to say. When faced with the knowledge and power of God, Elihu's words rung true. How can Job claim that God's uncaring when God understands and cares for his whole creation? How can he claim that he is righteous or think to argue with God and prove himself right when God created the whole earth, even down to the foundations of the earth? So then God continues in chapter 40 and 41. He challenges Job and he asks Job if he has the power to humble all the proud, to destroy all the wicked. And then God goes on to talk about two animals. He talks about Behemoth and he talks about Leviathan. These are animals of extreme violence. Leviathan is uncatchable. He's untamable. He's uncontrollable. He's fierce. He's proud. He's unkillable. Leviathan laughs at weapons and is king over all. And God says, I created Leviathan. And then God finishes speaking. So what has God said? God has shown that he causes everything and does everything for a purpose. He's shown that he oversees the whole earth and is attentive towards all creation. He's shown Job that he cares about all his creation, even the wild animals and the young goats. And so how much more does he care for Job, one of his faithful servants? So what's Job's response? This brings us to the end of the story, chapter 42. Chapter 42, verse 1 to 6. Let's read all six verses. Job answered Yahweh and said, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." So the story concludes. That's Job's response to God. He then prays for his friends. He begs God to forgive them, and God restores Job to prosperity. Job is blessed more than he had before. He receives double of all that he had, and he lives for another 140 years. So what have we seen? We've seen Job's faith shine from the beginning of the story. In his passionate commitment to serving God, to helping others, to caring for his family and ensuring that his family are right with God. Then we've seen Job's faith shine through his suffering. We saw his incredible response at the end of chapter 1 and his faithful reply to his wife. Both showed his faith. And now at the end of the story, we see Job's faith shine through even brighter than it did before. How would we respond to God's words in chapters 38 to 41 if he spoke to us like that? If he spoke to us and declared his power and all of his glory? Well, Job's response is amazing. He says, "I know, God, that you can do everything." That's absolute belief in God's power. Job says, "Therefore have I uttered that I understood not things too wonderful for me." That's in verse 3. That's total acknowledgement of ignorance and lesser understanding. He acknowledges that he doesn't understand as much as God. And then in verse 6, Job's final part of his response, "Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." That's a complete confession of unworthiness and humility. Job didn't turn and flee or question further when God finished speaking. Instead, he honored God with what he said, and he humbly proclaimed God's righteousness and his own unworthiness. Job's faith here is strengthened and perfected. Gone is the man that called for a meeting with God so that he could argue his case. Instead, here is a man that humbly proclaimed God's wonder and the smallness of himself in God's work. Job's now got the faith to know that no matter what happens in life, God is in control. Job now has the faith to know that no matter the unexplainable trials or suffering, he can be 100% convinced that God knows and cares, and that there is a purpose, for God is righteous and just and good. So finally, what have we learnt from this story? Well, first, we saw the incredible description of Job in chapter 1, where he's described as perfect and upright. What an encouragement that is to us. What an inspiring way for a servant of God to be described. Wherein we too should strive to be described as perfect and upright, that God can look at us and say that we were blameless. We then saw the incredible passion that Job had for making sure that his family was also right in God's sight. And we're inspired to care about the faith of those around us with the same passion that Job had, to ensure that everyone around us is right in God's sight, not just us. Then we looked at Job's friends. We saw how genuine they were. We saw that selfless friendship, the ability to sit with Job for days and days and days. And that's something we should take on too. They could have spent their time on their other commitments, on their job, on seeing their family, on their business, but they give it to their friend Job. And finally, at the end of this story, we saw how Job was taught that God is in control. We're reassured that God knows, that God cares, and that God acts with a purpose. Put simply, Job learned to have the faith to trust God. So thanks for listening to me tonight, and may God bless us as we all walk towards his kingdom.